Most of us are not aware of Iran's old relationship with Yemen and the Yemeni people. In fact, the relationship dates back to the Sassanid era, around 535 AD, when Khosrow I, or better known as Anushirvan, was in power. Ethiopia attacked Yemen and occupied the country. Someone from Yemen went to Anushirvan's palace and asked for help in the face of the Ethiopian Christians' oppression in Yemen and asked the king to help his people. But the incident had an international aspect as well. To understand what was going on, we need an ancient map. We're in Sana'a, in the old section of the city called Old City. UNESCO has put it on the list of World Heritage Sites. In the recent war, Saudi airstrikes have demolished parts of the ancient city, but you can still see images of ancient world in the ruins of the city. And now we fast forward in history and reach the era when Anushirvan and the Sassanids did not exist any longer. Iran's interests have also changed. Iran, as an Islamic country, isn't after military expansionism, but after friendship with Islamic countries. But the friendship has its own hardships as well. Yemen is an old land that has been mentioned in old Greek books and the Holy Book. Romans call it Happy Arabia. The reason for the name was the seasonal rains that made Yemen green and filled with water, as opposed to Saudi Arabia. In old myths, a large dam has been mentioned that kept a huge amount of water reserves for agriculture in Yemen, but the dam broke and Yemen was flooded. In 1973, ancient copies of the Quran that were transcribed in ancient Yemeni calligraphy were discovered at the heart of this very mosque. The copies of the Quran were from the 1st century AH. They were probably transcribed by Imam Ali, peace be upon him. All this means Sana'a, and hence North Yemen, was ancient. It's always been more significant. South Yemen, whose capital was Aden, has been mostly tied to the modern era. South Yemen stretches from the Bab al-Mandab Strait to Oman's border and was still controlled by Britain when North Yemen gained independence from the Ottoman Empire. North Yemen was controlled by followers of the Zaydis. So who were the followers of the Zaydis? The Zaydi imams in Yemen started their activities in 284 AH. It was exactly the time when the Zaydi movement was at its peak in Gilan and Mazandaran provinces. As opposed to Iran, the Zaydi dynasty lived on in Yemen from 284 AH to World War I and Imam Yahya's ruling. 65 Zaydi imams were in power in Yemen. During the 1300 years of Zaydi's presence in Yemen, half of the people in Yemen joined Zaydis and established a close relationship with the Prophet's household. The ruling of Zaydis in Yemen wasn't just a political ruling, it had strong spiritual ties with the people, but things did not remain like that. The advent of Arab nationalism in the region was like a wave against religious sentiments in the world of Islam. Gamal Abdel Nasser was a young officer who launched an uprising in Egypt and toppled the monarchy. Even though he aimed at fighting with the British colonial rule, he did not have cordial ties with movements like Zaydism. Nasser's uprising was considered a secular movement and soon received support from governments like the Soviet Union. After World War II, Imam Yahya was killed in a coup. After the coup by Gamal Abdel Nasser dealt a lethal blow to the Zaydi rule in Yemen, Imam Yahya's son's rule came to an end in 1962. During this period that the North Yemen witnessed all these incidents, South Yemen was still colonized by Britain. These are the images from the British Queen, who was about to grant knighthood to some of its subjects in Aden, a part of British imperialism in the Arabian Peninsula. The other part is in the south of the Persian Gulf. The Emirates and monarchies that are today known as the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain. But within the colony in the Yemeni part, 23 sultans and emirs have ruled, and there were several independent tribes. Yemen was a country with 1,000 tribes. Under those circumstances, the only major unity was arguably between the Zaydis, the biggest religious unity that was formed from any tribes. One of those tribes was the Houthi tribe. The Hamdan tribe converted to Islam in the 10th century AH after Imam Ali, peace be upon him, came to Yemen. Later on, the Hamdan tribe joined Imam Ali's army in the Battle of Siffin. Hamdanis have been praised for resistance under the harshest circumstances. The Houthis are one of the branches of the Hamdan tribe in North Yemen. But North Yemen was no longer ruled by Zaydis, and Arab nationalists had taken control, namely supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Yemen. South Yemen, that was colonized by Britain, was in a worse situation. After Britain withdrew, those who were openly supporters of the Soviet Union and called themselves socialists took power. They were even more extremist than Nasser's supporters. The consequences of differences in a tribal country like Yemen were clear. North and South Yemen got involved in a war in 1972. After the conflict, Ali Abdullah Saleh came to power in North Yemen. But who was Ali Abdullah Saleh? The Sanhan tribe was also one of the tribes in Yemen. Saleh belonged to that tribe and joined the army of Imamit during the Zaydis' rule. He took part in a coup waged by Nasser's supporters to topple the Zaydis. Saleh gained a lot of power after that coup. After the war between the North and South Yemen ended, he became Yemen's president. In 1986, a civil war broke out in South Yemen, but the civil war was the prelude to the unity between North and South. Actually, Arab states had decided to put an end to the rift between North and South Yemen and turn them into a united Yemen. After the civil war ended, the then South Yemeni president fled. The new governments in South and North Yemen made a unity agreement. Both Yemens were going to unite. Ali Abdullah Saleh, North Yemen's president, became the president of the United Yemen. Ali Salem Al Bayt, the president of South Yemen, became vice president of the United Yemen. In 1990, the North and South signed an agreement and Yemen became united. But it wasn't a happy ending for Yemen. Tragic incidents were on the horizon. In 1991, the U.S. attacked Iraq for the first time under the pretext of Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. The U.S. tried to push the U.N. Security Council to issue a resolution for their invasion of Iraq and give their military campaign a lawful facade. From the unity in 1990 to 1991, Yemen was a member of the Security Council. When the U.S. introduced the resolution to the Security Council, it expected Yemen to vote for it, but Yemen abstained. Several U.S. resolutions regarding Iraq and Kuwait were faced with Yemen's abstentions. Yemenis said that they're against resorting to violence, and the U.S. decided to retaliate. Washington gave Riyadh the thumbs up to repatriate 800,000 Yemeni migrants from Saudi Arabia. The Saleh administration had no plan to develop the country. In fact, the tribal system would not allow the development. Yemen did not have oil or any other considerable resources for export. It is known as the poorest Arab country. Soon, protests were staged over food. Ali Salem al-Bayt, the former South Yemeni president, who had become the vice president of the United Yemen, stepped down. He claimed that South Yemen had been marginalized and the North had gone overboard to crack down on protests in the South. It was the beginning of the civil war. The impoverished nation of Yemen became poorer and poorer, war in and war out. South Yemen was eventually defeated, and North Yemen imposed its rule on the southerners at gunpoint. During the war and after the chasms emerged between the U.S. and Ali Abdullah Saleh's government, Saudi Arabia sided with the South, but its plan failed. The civil war ended in the summer of 1994. The historical ruins named Yemen were completely controlled by Ali Abdullah Saleh. In 2000, a U.S. military warship was attacked by Al-Qaeda on the shores of Aden. 17 U.S. Navy personnel were killed. It was a year before the 9/11 attacks. Everyone knows that just like Afghanistan, the tribal atmosphere in Yemen will allow Al-Qaeda to gain a foothold in the country. After the 9/11 attacks, Saleh got close to George Bush in the U.S. and announced that he was an ally in the war against Al-Qaeda. In 2004, the Zaydi Shias in Yemen under the leadership of the Houthis rose up from Sada'a. The leader of the uprising was Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi. Saleh accused them of trying to topple the regime, but the Houthis said that they had risen up only to protect the bias against the Zaydi Shias. In 2005, the protests intensified after 36 people were killed in a police shooting. Concurrent with the protests by the Shias, Al-Qaeda stepped up its activities in Yemen as well. In the winter of 2008, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, was formed. It was a combination of the Saudi and Yemeni branches. Many of the AQAP members had been in U.S. prison in Guantanamo. Even if they weren't al-Qaeda militants in the past, now they're filled with rage and have joined the militant group. Ali Abdullah Saleh released 176 al-Qaeda militants under the pretext of good conduct, and after a while turned the heat up on the Shias by cracking down on their protests. However, Saleh's efforts to suppress the Shias failed. He wasn't aware that the Shias in Yemen had launched a different movement. Saudi officials didn't know Hussein Badruddin Houthi very well and weren't aware of the developments in the region. Something new had happened that would soon engulf many Arab countries, including Yemen.
وناديناه أن يا إبراهيم قد صدقت الرؤيا إنا كذلك نجزي المحسنين.
And we called out to him saying, O Ibrahim, you have indeed shown the truth of the vision. Surely thus do we reward the doers of good. Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, celebrates and honors the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ismail as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate all of our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice.
In the limelight.
The highly transmissible BA5 Omicron subvariant is now the dominant coronavirus strain in the U.S., accounting for nearly 54% of COVID-19 infections last week, according to estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Madeline Halpert, Forbes staff. This article is published under the heading, Highly Contagious BA5 Variant Becomes Dominant in U.S. as COVID Cases Rise. Here's the story. The highly transmissible BA5 Omicron subvariant is now the dominant coronavirus strain in the U.S., accounting for nearly 54% of COVID-19 infections last week, according to estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as cases rise and drug companies work to reformulate vaccines to target new virus strains known for their ability to evade antibodies. BA5 and the closely related Omicron sub-strain, BA4, comprised 70% of coronavirus infections for the week ending July 2nd, according to CDC estimates, which may be subject to changes. The BA2.1.12 variant, which helped fuel a spike in COVID-19 cases when it was dominant in the spring in the U.S., accounted for only 27% of cases last week. The news comes a week after the Food and Drug Administration recommended that pharmaceutical companies update their coronavirus vaccine booster shots by the fall to target BA4 and BA5 in anticipation of a winter COVID-19 surge. It also comes as COVID-19 cases have been on the rise in recent months, with the United States averaging 94,345 new infections per day in the week ending July 4th, more than triple the 30,558 daily cases reported as of April 10th, but well below the January peak of more than 800,000 per day. Hospitalizations have trended upwards too. COVID-19 hospital admissions averaged 4,376 per day in the 7-day period ending July 3rd, more than twice the average of 1,428 per day in early April, though numbers are still much lower than during the winter coronavirus surge when daily hospitalizations topped 20,000. Over 16% of U.S. coronavirus tests came back positive on average last week, the highest positivity rate since early February, according to CDC. BA4 and BA5 were first discovered earlier this year in South Africa, where the strains became dominant and they eventually made their way into the U.S. in late March, though Omicron substrain BA2 remained the dominant variant for several weeks. All three of the substrains have specific mutations in their spike proteins, the part of the virus that binds to the human cell that help them evade the immune system, with data suggesting BA5 is even better at escaping antibodies from previous coronavirus infections and vaccines. Countries around the world, like the UK, are also seeing a spike in cases as BA4 and BA5 become their most prevalent coronavirus strains. BA4 and BA5 combined became the dominant COVID-19 substrains in the US 2 weeks ago, accounting for 55% of cases. A continued spike in COVID-19 cases in the U.S. over the summer. The rise in new subvariants that are even more contagious than previous strains and capable of escaping the immune system suggests substantial circulation of virus this summer. Dan Barak, director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Boston Beth Medical Center, told the Wall Street Journal recently.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today. Africa Today.
Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis that has aggravated the country's economic conditions since President Kais Saied ousted the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority last year. Now, the crisis worsened when the president announced in March this year that he was dissolving the parliament. Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the political crisis unfolding in Tunisia following drastic measures taken by the president to dissolve the elected parliament and dismiss scores of judges. We are asking, what direction will this North African country take after a referendum is held later this month? In the second part of our show today, we are discussing the continued impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders.
Tunisia in political turmoil. In July 2021, President Kais Saied dismissed the prime minister and suspended parliament. The Tunisian president said at the time that his decision was meant to save Tunisia, the state, and the Tunisian people. In the midst of growing public anger and protests against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, President Saied's decision was welcomed by many Tunisians tired of a frequently deadlocked post-revolutionary democracy. However, in a pointer to a polarized country, thousands of Tunisians opposed to the move have continued to hold demonstrations across the country.
As part of his reform agenda, President Saied has organized a referendum on a new constitution that his opponents claim will cement his hold on power. Sadouk Belaid, coordinator of the National Consultative Commission for a New Republic, charged with drafting the new document, speaks here after presenting the draft constitution to President Saied.
The conditions for drafting the constitution were difficult because of the short time we had at our disposal. But we managed, thanks to everyone's efforts, to submit this first version of the constitution. We hope that this will satisfy the president.
Now, to discuss the unfolding situation in Tunisia, we contacted Hamdi, the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, Tunisians are protesting against a constitutional referendum called by President Saied. This draft constitution has been produced through a national dialogue that excluded the main opposition forces and was boycotted by the powerful UGTT Trade Union Confederation. Now, can it bring the desired results of political stability and progress in Tunisia?
I think it's important to remember or stress that the constitution that was overthrown by Kais Saied, the 2014 constitution, was negotiated by an elected parliament for over 3 years, clause by clause. It was carefully negotiated, carefully drafted, carefully discussed, carefully debated, and then it was presented in 2014. Kais Saied's constitution, however, has been drawn up in less than 30 days by a select group of individuals specifically appointed by Kais Saied without the input of the experts who refused to participate in his commission to draft the constitution, and without the input of the opposition political parties, or indeed any political party that has been elected by the Tunisian people. In other words, it's a unilaterally written constitution in accordance with the desires of Kais Saied, and therefore this is an imposition of a constitution as opposed to a democratic constitution, and therefore it's very unlikely that it's going to lead to this political stability that Kais Saied promises, especially given that even the trade unions who support the coup have announced that they are not going to support his constitution or support his roadmap.
The first article of Tunisia's 2014 constitution and its 1959 predecessor defined the country as a free, independent, and sovereign state. Islam is its religion and Arabic is its language. However, Tunisian President Kais Saied now says that the draft constitution to be put to a referendum on July 25 will not enshrine Islam as the religion of the state. What led to this decision and what is the significance of this announcement, especially considering that Ennahda, an Islamic party, is one of the most popular parties in the country?
I think it's important to remember one thing. The first is that Tunisia has often wrestled with the Islamic identity and has often wrestled with the Islamic identity in a bid to try to win international support. Kais Saied is removing Islam from the constitution in contradiction to what he said in 2014 when he said that this is a clause that should be supported. Kais Saied has removed this clause in the constitution in a bid to present his own coup as progressive to an international community that is not comfortable with his coup.
President Saied also dismissed 57 judges on June 1st, accusing them of corruption and protecting terrorists. The Tunisian Judges Association has rejected the charges, saying they are mostly politically motivated. Analysts believe the judges have been removed for failing to toe the president's line.
I think it's important to remember that since Kais Saied seized power for himself on the 25th of July 2021, almost a year ago, he's been dragging his political opponents before the courts and before military courts in a bid to try to convict them on charges of corruption. The idea here is that if Saied can convict his political opponents of corruption, then he can, by extension, convict the democratic process that he's overthrown of corruption. He can argue and say that I've overthrown a corrupt democratic process, and the proof is that these political opponents who have been elected are guilty of corruption.
Recently, Tunisia's main trade union confederation, UGTT, called up to 3 million public sector workers to strike, halting work at 159 state agencies and public companies to demand concessions on salaries and reforms. Now, UGTT chief Noureddin Tebboubi has also blamed the government for not including this powerful union in national dialogue. Now, what is the impact of the strike, and will the government respond positively to the workers' demands?
I think it's important to stress that the trade union strike against Kais Saied is not because of the conditions of the workers. It's not about workers' pay, even though that's what the trade unions claim it is about. Instead, it's about this power struggle that's unfolding between the trade unions and Kais Saied. The trade unions wholeheartedly backed Kais Saied's coup, but they believe that Kais Saied would be subservient to them, that they would be able to control Kais Saied, they would be able to influence Kais Saied, and they would be able to impose their own desire on the process of the coup in a manner similar to what they did with the National Dialogue in 2013-2014. The problem, however, for the trade unions is that Kais Saied has monopolized power. He refuses to share power. He refuses to engage with the trade unions. The problem the trade unions have is that they don't want this coup to fall because they don't want the Islamists to come back to power. The leftist trade unions have a rabid hatred for the Islamists and are very frustrated that the Islamists keep winning in the democratic elections. So they want this coup to stay. The problem, however, is that Saied is not engaging them, and they are worried about going hard against Saied because they don't want this coup to topple.
The head UGTT trade union has rejected international monetary fund conditions for a new loan to bail out Tunisia's struggling economy and has questioned the government's authority to negotiate. President Saied has made concessions demanded by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, cutting subsidies and wages.
An economist says if the government fails to convince the population, then it will not be able to implement economic reforms.
The negotiations with the IMF will take place amid an unprecedented economic crisis in Tunisia. Therefore, the authorities will make many sacrifices. The government needs to convince the population that the reforms are necessary. Otherwise, it will not be able to implement any change or reform.
Now, why is the president obeying these IMF conditions at the expense of the welfare of the people?
I think when it comes to the negotiations regarding the IMF, it's important to remember that Tunisia is in a very dire economic situation that is spiraling out of control and spiraling into ever-increasing crises and woes for the ordinary Tunisian. The reason that the Tunisians protested against the democratic transition or protested against parliament, the reason why many Tunisians are not interested in seeing parliament return, which is something that has helped Kais Saied, is because they believe that the parliament has not delivered on the aspirations of the Arab Spring, which were rooted in economic development. They wanted better jobs. They wanted they wanted the alleviation of poverty. They wanted equal opportunities. They wanted a better standard of living. None of that has been delivered. And Qais Saied is aware that as in 2016, 2017, Yusuf Shahid, the prime minister then, also had very high poll ratings when he first came to power, and he was seen as combating corruption. But Yusuf Shahid's failure to tackle the economy meant that people very quickly turned against him.
Amid the political crisis in Tunisia, the government recently announced that it had launched an investigation of an attempt to assassinate President Kais Saied. Justice Minister Hasna Ben Saliman told a local radio that she approved the Court of Appeals prosecutor investigating the attempt, but gave no further details.
Now, our last question. Where is Tunisia heading in the next months and years amid the political turmoil and economic crisis?
I think the reality is that the international community appears to be approaching Qais Saied's coup as with the approach that is similar to that with which they approached the coup in Egypt when Sisi overthrew the democratically elected president. They are aware they are unable to get enough people to the streets to demand the return of parliament, and they've also changed tactic into recognizing the suspension of parliament but asking for an inclusive national dialogue, essentially offering a concession to recognize Saied's emergency measures in exchange for being included in the political process. And I think this is the tragedy of what is unfolding in Tunisia, in that at this moment in time, because of the dire economic situation, there's a lack of appreciation as to the importance of the democratic transition and more a focus on who can deal with the economic crisis, who can deal, whether it's democracy or dictatorship, just as long as they can deal with the economic crisis. And I think this apathy towards the democratic process is what benefits Qais Saied.
Well, there you have it. The dire economic situation in Tunisia has created apathy towards the democratic process in the country. We'd like to thank our guest Sami Hamdi for his incisive analysis, and we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the continuing impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders. Stay with us.
African leaders snub Ukrainian president.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
On the 20th of June, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, addressed the African Union during a virtual meeting in which only four heads of state from the continent took part.
According to reports, all the heads of state of the continent were invited. But apart from the African Union chairman, President Macky Sall of Senegal, only three of them participated from their respective presidential offices: Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast, Mohamed El Menfi, president of the Libyan Council, and Denis Sassou Nguesso of Congo. In his belated address, the Ukrainian president tried to convince the few African leaders listening to him that the conflict in his country was the reason for the sharp increase in food prices.
This war may seem very distant to you and your countries, but catastrophically rising food prices have already brought it home to millions of African families.
Many in Africa hold the view that the conflict in Ukraine was imposed by Western powers. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has openly blamed the US-led NATO military alliance for the war in Ukraine and said he will resist calls to condemn Russia.
For us, this is an important development. Whilst other people scream and shout, we want to focus on the outcome, the positive outcome of those negotiations and that mediation process. That is what is important.
For more on the conflict in Ukraine and its impact on Africa, we contacted Tshepo Magema, a former member of South African Parliament. Now, only four presidents were interested in holding a video conference with the Ukrainian president, while he had requested to address all African leaders after months of intense lobbying. Now, why did African leaders decide to snub Zelensky?
There is a general feeling both amongst the population of the African continent and the leadership that this is a war that should not have happened. It is a war that could have been prevented, but for the hubris and arrogance of Western leaders, in particular the EU and the US. And so it led us and left us in this situation. And so there is that sense that, look, we don't want to be drawn into what is essentially a US / EU / NATO war, you know, against Russia. And so there is that understanding that Russia had to act in one way or the other.
When the Ukrainian president was given a chance to address African Union leaders, he claimed that Africa is in reality a hostage of Russia's war. Let's listen in.
Africa is actually taken hostage, hostage of those who started the war against our state.
Remarks by the Ukrainian president have been termed by many as arrogant and typical of Europe's condescending attitudes towards Africa. Now, Mr. Magema, what's your take on these remarks by the Ukrainian president?
Look, generally as Africans, we take umbrage, you know, at such arrogance for, you know, especially Westerners to want to tell us what our state is, you know, what our conditions are. We are very clear, we are nobody's hostage. And indeed, the AU has taken such a position in general in terms of its attitude that we are nobody's hostage. We are indeed, you know, there are some challenges that arise out of this thing, but we reject the notion, you know, that we are hostage as if, as Africans, we do not have agency to act. And so it's actually, we see it as an affront to African agency to really, you know, engage with the world and do business and pursue our own interests, you know, as Africans. So, but then again, it is that kind of racist arrogance that we have, you know, become accustomed to, and notwithstanding the fact that we've been rejecting it for all the centuries of colonialism since we got into contact with Western civilization. So in that sense, that statement means nothing to us. We don't see ourselves as hostages.
Well, the European Union has aggressively pursued sanctions and severing of economic ties in a bid to punish Russia for its military operations in Ukraine, a strategy that has attracted widespread criticism.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said that bystander countries were suffering due to sanctions against Russia.
Now, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia are going to have and are having an overarching impact. Even those countries that are either bystanders or not part of the conflict are also going to suffer from the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia.
After imposing sanctions, Western countries are accusing Russia of being behind a worsening food shortage in Africa. Is it agreeable to claim that Russia is the main reason behind the so-called food crisis in Africa?
It seems to me that, you know, a food crisis in Africa, put in those terms, is really being used as a, you know, as a beating stick, a stick to beat Russia with, to say, but Russia, you are responsible for a food crisis in Africa, because Africa, of course, is one of those vulnerable parts of the world where we have famines and food crises. breaking out every, you know, now and then, every decade or two or so. And so in that sense, you know, Africa, the crisis is not as deep, at least as some would suggest.
Since the beginning of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, people in Africa condemn the double standards of treatment of African nationals. Many Africans were physically attacked by Ukrainian police and endured maltreatment from the country's authorities, including being left stranded and helpless in freezing temperatures. An African student speaks after escaping a harrowing experience in Ukraine.
I remember they punched a certain black guy, a policeman in Ukraine, punched a certain black guy for nothing. He was shocked for nothing. Yes, so like I said earlier on, they consider white people before considering black people.
Volodymyr Zelensky said in February that any African students who leave Ukraine will not be welcome there once the war is over. Africans will certainly never forget how they experienced racism while trying to escape the conflict in Ukraine.
Now, regardless of whether the conflict in Ukraine is the source of the food crisis in Africa or not, many agree that the continent needs to end dependence on food imports. The president of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, says the bank is funding agricultural projects in the continent to end dependency on imports.
We have a $1.5 billion facility. It's not just the money. We have the systems in place across Africa, and that facility will allow African countries to produce 38 million metric tons of food. I told you we'll lose 30 million metric tons of food from Russia. So it produced 38 million metric tons of food. But that food will be broken down into what we're actually dealing with. There will be 11 million metric tons that will be wheat. There will be 18 million metric tons that will be maize. There will be 6 million metric tons that will be rice. 2.5 million metric tons, that will be soybeans.
Now, what can African countries learn from the conflict in Ukraine, especially in terms of reviving agriculture and rebuilding regional sovereign grain reserves to avoid the current situation?
There's about 70% of the world's available arable land cannot ensure its food security. And so it's crucial that, African leaders in earnest begin to work on practical projects, bankable projects that will ensure, grain and wheat and fertilizer production on the continent. But that also, I must add, will require that we push the IMF and World Bank, who have, in fact, in many ways deindustrialized our agricultural sector and made it less profitable for African countries to grow their own food, vis-a-vis the importation of cheap products from abroad. And so that is the strategic task that face our continent and its leaders. And there needs to be really a lot of work. I mean, South Africa is doing well in that regard. It's a net exporter. That work must still continue and be expanded.
Well, indeed, Africa needs to ensure self-reliance in food security, and this requires dedicated leadership. We'd like to thank our guest, Isetho Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
False claims about the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's January 6 investigation featured prominently during the Republican Wyoming primary debate as Representative Liz Cheney faced off against four challengers, including the Donald Trump-backed Harriet Hakeman. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ewan Palmer. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Liz Cheney and Trump-backed Challenger Clash at Wyoming GOP Debate. False claims about the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's January 6 investigation featured prominently during the Republican Wyoming primary debate as Representative Liz Cheney faced off against four challengers, including the Donald Trump-backed Harriet Hageman. The debate, hosted by Wyoming PBS, saw Liz Cheney, Harriet Hageman, Robin Belinsky, Senator Anthony Bouchard, and Denton Knapp discuss a number of issues ahead of the August 16 primary, including how to deal with rising inflation and infrastructure development. However, it was the 2020 presidential election and the House Select Committee's investigation into the riot at the U.S. Capitol, of which Liz Cheney is a vice chair, that dominated proceedings. Liz Cheney, who is fighting for a political future after being censured by the Republican National Committee and the Wyoming GOP voting to no longer recognize her as part of the party due to her role on the January 6 panel and criticism of Donald Trump, fought accusations from Harriet Hageman that the panel was not relevant to the people of Wyoming. "We have a committee in Congress right now. They're focusing on something that happened 18 months ago," Hageman said. "They're not focusing on the issues that are important to the people in Wyoming, and they're also ignoring the corruption that is absolutely destroying Washington, D.C., and as a result, taking down the rest of the country." Liz Cheney, one of just two Republicans on the January 6 committee, defended her role on the House panel and continued her attacks on Hageman and former President Donald Trump. "There's a real tragedy that's occurring, and the tragedy is that there are politicians in this country, beginning with Donald Trump, who have lied to the American people, and people have been betrayed," Cheney said. She added, "He consistently has said that the election was stolen when it wasn't." Liz Cheney also noted how former Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien, who is now an advisor to Harriet Hageman's campaign, testified to the January 6 panel that Donald Trump had no basis to declare himself the winner on election night in November of 2020, before all the votes had been counted. Liz Cheney said, "I'd be interested to know whether or not my opponent, Ms. Hageman, is willing to say here tonight that the election was not stolen. She knows it wasn't stolen. I think that she can't say that it wasn't stolen because she's completely beholden to Donald Trump." Liz Cheney again urged Harriet Hageman to admit she supports Trump's false claim about the 2020 election elsewhere during the debate. Hageman is standing up here claiming that the election was stolen or that there was fraud. That was sufficient to overturn the election, Cheney said. She ought to say it, otherwise she needs to stop making claims that are not true, and she ought to tell the people of Wyoming the truth. While Harriet Hageman did not directly say she believed that the last election was stolen from Donald Trump by voter fraud, an unfounded accusation that has been debunked multiple times, she did say she shared concerns about its legitimacy that other Americans have. Hageman referenced highly disputed claims about the use of drop boxes made in the conspiracy theory-riddled documentary 2000 Mules, created by right-wing political commentator Dinesh D'Souza, as a great concern. According to an internal opinion poll from a pro-Hageman group released in June, the Trump-backed candidate has the support of 56% of voters, compared to 28% who said they would back Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney has managed to raise millions more dollars than Harriet Hageman during her re-election campaign. However, a significant amount of the money is coming from out of state and from those who cannot vote for her. The debate on Thursday, 30th of June, was not open to the public after one of the candidates received death threats, according to Wyoming PBS.
Have you heard of the Bilderberg Group? Probably not. Well, that's understandable because members of the group work really hard to remain anonymous. The Bilderberg Group consists of between 120 to 150 powerful people who meet for 3 days once a year to discuss foreign policy. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Now, since 1954, the Bilderberg Group has been gathering in secret to discuss everything from the rise and fall of communism to nuclear warfare to cybersecurity. The group began as a way to create more cooperation between Europe and North America during the Cold War. Bilderberg releases an annual list of people who will attend and topics they will discuss, but beyond that, little leaves the walls of the meeting rooms. We disclose the truth behind the group's agenda.
We are endowed by our Creator with rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which nobody, no person, no group, no political party, not even our government, can take away from us.
Hitler had a dream that his big business should dominate the world. He called his dream the New Order.
We've already amended the Constitution dozens of times. Let's throw it away for a master plan run by a master state.
Morgan is the largest group. Then there is the strong Kuhn Loeb group, the Mellon interests, which have Westinghouse, DuPont with General Motors, and then there is Rockefeller and three other groups, making up a grand total of some $82 billion assets in 1945. Eight groups control the American economy, not only because of their concentration of wealth, but through their strategic ownership of basic industries. In spite of war, these companies operate internationally through subsidiaries, stock participation, and cartel agreements with various other companies.
Have you ever heard of the Bilderberg Group?
No.
Yeah.
No, never.
No, I haven't.
No, I haven't heard of that.
I don't know too much about that Bilderberg thing.
Have you guys ever heard about a group called the Bilderberg Group?
No.
Yeah, for the most part.
I have not.
Sounds kind of familiar, but I couldn't tell you what it was.
No, never heard of them.
Have you ever heard of a group called the Bilderberg Group?
No, I haven't.
The Bilderberg?
Well, what would you say if I told you it's a group of about 120 people on average who meet once a year?